Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jason Randall, and he'll be answering most of your questions on mastering the nymph. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up so that you can receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Jason Randall about mastering the nymph. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak Rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kick boats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. That's bigskyinflatables.com. Before we introduce Jason, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Jason's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Jason's book, Nymph Masters, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And to see more about what Stackpole has to offer, go to stackpolebooks.com. You'll see all kinds of books on fly fishing, fly tying, and so forth. So to win Jason's book tonight, you're going to have to be the first person to answer a question that we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something that Jason and I talk about during the show, and so submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. And if you're the first one to answer the question, or if it's a two-part question, then you'll win Jason's book, which I know you'll want. And, of course, if anybody, the rest of you that don't win, hey, check it out on Amazon and our Stackpole and get your own copy because you'll want to do just that. Now, I noticed tonight, because we do use a third-party system that collects the questions, the question box is a little bit different, and it's not giving an option to refresh itself for multiple questions. So you're going to have to refresh that home page to get another view to ask a second question. So just wanted to make sure you knew about that, because it is acting differently. I'll have to call the company and get it worked out. But anyway, that's that. Our guest tonight is Jason Randall. Jason is a veterinarian certified in fish health and medicine. He's also a member of the World Aquatic Veterinarian Medical Association and Society for Freshwater Science. He's been an outdoor writer for the last 10 years, with articles appearing regularly in American Angler, Eastern Fly Fishing, and many other outdoor magazines. His book, Moving Water, A Fly Fisher's Guide to Currents, was released in 2012 by Stackpole Books. It studies the effect of current on trout, their prey species and presentation, where vertical layers of current drag, and requires adjustments to improve nymph fishing success. His second book, Feeding Time, A Fly Fisher's Guide to What, Where, and When Trout Eat, was released in 2013. It focuses on matching your fishing strategies to the trout's feeding strategies especially when targeting large trout. Because if you know the 5W questions for large trout feeding, who, what, when, where, and why, you can catch them regularly. Well, Jason, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fish Internet Radio. It's been a while, but it takes a while to write a book, doesn't it?
It sure does, Roger. Thanks. It's great to be back. It was also great to see you at the Denver Fly Fishing Show recently, too.
Yeah. It's you've got another book out, and it's another winner in my mind. And I've been able to read parts of it, but it's going to be on my reading stand here for the next few weeks as we really get into fishing season, because I think there's a lot to be learned in there. So I'm anxious to get through the whole thing. But so congratulations on that. Well deserved.
Yeah, thank you. It was a fun book to work on, and it's called Nymph Masters Fly Fishing Secrets from Expert Anglers, and it really kind of corroborated tips and ideas from, I think, some of the best nymph fishing anglers in our sport.
Yeah. So, what brought you to write the book? Did you go out with the intent of doing it this way, or was it more as a compilation of things over the years? How did it all come about?
There's an awful lot of confusion, I think, in the realm of fly fishing, probably more here than in any other style of fly fishing in our sport. It's a lot of it is due to the rapid change and development of some of these new techniques. There's been more change in that area of our sport in nymph fishing in the last 20 years than I think there has been in the previous 100 years, perhaps. And there's so many different, seemingly conflicting ideas, theories, information, different opinions, and sometimes even contradictory. And I think the corroborative effort that we wanted in this book helped consolidate and explain a lot of these different viewpoints and methods. We wanted really some type of an explanation for why all these seemingly different methods work. And we found that it's really because each method addresses and solves some fundamental problems that's inherent in nymph fishing. And, you know, once these are understood, then it really makes sense of why all these different techniques work. It helps demystify a lot of these different methods. It makes them more simple and easier to understand. And instead of being overwhelmed by them, by the difference in the complexities, we go, aha, that's why that works. And then from that, we can build and understand some of the newer cutting-edge techniques that are at the forefront of our sport and allow us to build on these. And I think it really helps a lot. It amazed me how each one of the nymph masters really solved the same problem, perhaps in a different way, but solved the same problem in nymph fishing.
Yeah, that is interesting. There's no one right way, is there?
That's right.
I know, taking from your book, you talked about challenges that we face with nymphing. You want to go through a few of those about,
sure.
Because I thought
sure.
That was very, really kind of enlightening to think of it in that way. So can you kind of go over what you talk about in the book a bit?
Well, the first, at least understanding part of these challenges came from research that was involved in the first book, Moving Water, A Fly Fisher's Guide to Currents, and understanding the structure and layer of currents. So much of the research came from there. Then the rest of the research was the funnest part, actually going out and fishing with some of the best experts in our sport, some very, very good friends who happen to be also very, very good nymph fishermen. I mean, that's kind of like doing research on different recipes of chocolate cake, right?
Yeah.
How can you go wrong?
Right,
it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of great experiences and shared a lot of time and stories and even a lot of misadventures along the way, some of the funny things that happened. One of the ones that sticks out in my mind was fishing with Landon Mayer, who is probably one of the top big fish guides in our sport in the country. And we were fishing his home waters in Colorado on the South Platte. And It was high water, and we waded across, pretty easily to an island where we wanted to fish. And then wading back, though, is where we got into trouble. For some reason, and I don't know why, we didn't wade back the same place that we came across. And so, you know, this water that looked to be about 18 inches deep or so was not. And if I don't know if you ever
I've been there. I know exactly what you're talking about.
If you ever saw the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, where they jump off the cliff.
Yeah.
Into the water, and Butch turns to Sundance and says, "Hey, it doesn't matter if you know how to swim, and the fall will probably kill you anyway."
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So we took that first step, and we were into our neck, and pedaling across the river, trying to find perches on the bottom. We were carried down river, and it took us a long time to finally get up on land like drowned rats, throwing our rods up. We had thrown gear up for quite a while, and we ended up crawling up and laughing hysterically. We had to go back and collect all our gear that we heaped up on bank. But just some funny things like that along the way. But I think the biggest challenges in nymph fishing, really, it comes down to one word, and that word is contact. We have lost contact with our flies. We have so much lack of contact that we don't even know when a fish picks up our fly. We have no accurate way of strike detection. And someone once told me that I'm probably missing, over half of the strikes that I get, and underwater filming has probably convinced me it's probably worse than that. So we've lost contact with our flies, and our flies have lost contact with the bottom. And so the bottom is the nymph fishing strike zone, and that's where the food is, that's where the fish is, and that's where our flies need to be. And so essentially we have lost contact on two different aspects of contact. We've lost contact, our flies have lost contact with the bottom, and we've lost contact with our flies.
Yeah, interesting. So you talk about goals, too, that you have to create a successful nymph fishing system. What are those goals?
Well, I think we started out with the goals of being able to read a specific water type, whether it be a riffle or a run or a pool or a flat. And we wanted to be able to logically decide upon the best way of nymph fishing that way in that type of water to achieve those two points of contact. And I think that is also a goal as well, reestablishing contact on those two aspects, taking control of our drift. Don't let the river drift your flies. You want to control your own drift. And that's why so many of these different methods work. Each one may, through a different approach, may also achieve those two points of contact. That's a common thread. They may use a slightly different way to do it, but the goal is the same. Get the flies back in contact with the bottom layer, which is the strike zone where the fish and the food are, and then get better contact with our flies. So we really, and that gives us improved strike detection, but we really wanted to be able to look at any stretch of water, any type of water, and be able to to come upon logically the best method of achieving those two points of contact.
Yeah, and it seems in looking at a lot of the diagrams that you have in your book about, how a drift happens and where the fly goes and all those kinds of things, I'm just looking and I'm going, geez, I'm probably out of the zone about 85% of the time.
Yeah, and that's true. That's true. And if we look at the structure of water and we look at the three-dimensional river that we have to fish when we're nymph fishing, because we have, both forward, back, and to the sides, but we also have depth. So we have to deal with the three-dimensional aspect of current when we're nymph fishing. And so essentially if you look at a two-dimensional river from dry fly fishing, the water movement is fastest in the center of the stream and slower on the edges, and that's because of gravity and friction. Gravity pushes water downhill and friction slows it down, and the friction's at the edge of the rivers. But when we dry fly fish, we're casting across faster water and wanting our flies to stay in slower water, and we get drag as soon as as our slack is removed from our line and leader, our flies start dragging, and that pulls our dry flies out of the slow water on the edge of the stream and pulls them into the fast water, accelerates them, and it spoils our presentation. But the same thing happens in a vertical sense as well. There's a lot of friction at the stream bed, and the fastest flow in the current layers is in the center or the closer to the surface. At the bottom, that's where the strike zone is, but that current speed down there might be one quarter speed of the rest of the current that we might see from the surface. So if you take a floating indicator and attach it to your leader, and that indicator is going at the fastest speed of the current that you see, so are your flies. Your flies are being pulled up because of vertical drag in this sense, but it's the same old arch enemy we've always faced. It's the same drag. It pulls those flies up off the bottom into mid-current, accelerates them, and spoils the presentation. That bottom 6 inches in 4 feet of water is moving at one-quarter speed. So in a sense, if we want our flies to stay in the strike zone, they have to move at one-quarter speed, so we've got to slow them down. We have got to find methods to slow those flies down and let them drop out of the faster current and into the slower water near the bottom.
I know we'll talk about some techniques later on, but and I know you've studied the currents and all that extensively, especially in your other book. But the example you just gave of, let's say you have a strike indicator or suspension device, depending on who
that's
you
right,
talk
yeah,
to.
Depending on your nomenclature.
And the water is moving fast at the top and not at the bottom. So let's say I have a 9-foot leader and 3-foot of tippet, so I got 12 feet out there. If I have a 15-foot rig, then at the same with the strike indicator at the same point, am I still not getting to the bottom really because of the current differentiation?
That's true. And again, if you take it back to dry fly fishing where you can see everything, if you just put more line or leader out or more slack, if you will, what it does is it delays the onset of drag perhaps, but it also spoils your ability to set the hook or react quickly enough. And so that extra subsurface slack in the same thing will delay the onset of drag, but it's also going to thwart your strike detection. You're not going to know because of that slack if a fish picks up your fly, and if you even did nuance that it had, your strike detection is going to be, your hook set will be compromised.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll talk more about that in a bit, but we do have some questions about rods. Roger Campbell in Cheyenne, Wyoming wrote in, and he says, if you are fishing heavy nymphs and also anticipate fishing nymphs near the surface, such as emergers, and we're limited to only one rod and rod length, what rod length and weight and action would you choose? I guess you're just looking for an all-around nymph rod.
Yeah, you know, that's a tough one, too, and I think a lot of it is you're going to get a lot of different answers and some individual opinions on that. But if I'm limited to one rod in a situation, maybe I'm hiking somewhere, you know, and I can only really carry a limited amount of gear, you know, and I might think about fishing in several different styles when I get there, I might be looking at a convertible rod. There's a lot of newer rods on the market just in the last few years. TFO, the BBK series, makes a beautiful rod. It's a three-weight rod that converts from 8 feet to 10 feet, going from 4 pieces to 5 pieces. So I might just take a convertible rod with me because if I'm in really tight quarters, the last thing that I want on a real skinny stream with a lot of overhanging, you know, closely guarding vegetation is an 11-foot rod. I mean, that I'm going to be in the trees the whole time. And so that 8-foot rod, when I fished with Joe Humphreys, we fished in just that type of a situation. We fished a very, very narrow, overhanging type of a stream and a lot of closely guarded rhododendrons and other types of vegetation. If you had an 11-foot rod there, it just wouldn't work. He had probably an 8-foot rod, and it was delightful, a very small, lightweight rod. But then, you know, if I was finding myself in an open area, I might really want that longer rod, and so the convertible rod allows me to switch back and forth pretty easily. And so that might be my choice, and going to a longer rod, that 10-foot rod, would allow me to do some of the tight line Czech style or Polish style or French style techniques that an 8-foot rod might be a little less appropriate for.
Yeah, hopefully that answered Dave Hudak's question, too, from Ohio. He was asking about 10 and 11-foot rods, and because that seems to be the trend for Czech style or Euro style nymphing.
Yeah, it does. You see a lot of these, 10, even 11-foot rod, and they do have advantages. They allow you to reach over, river structure, fast current, maybe to extend the length of your reach. They also allow you to lift more line from the water in a situation where those tight line techniques, that's a real factor in presentation. So I do think that's true. And I think that the tendency is to go, he's talking about maybe rod weight then. The tendency, because of the rod position, oftentimes these are elevated and extended rods, maybe not straight up in the air, but certainly out over the river. A lot of this, the trend is to going to lighter weight rods. I just got a two-weight, a 10-foot rod, Maxia from Czechoslovakia, and delightful rod, but two-weight rods. And you're seeing more and more of these for these dedicated rods. But when you get a rod that's really specifically dedicated to one style of fishing like that, it's kind of what we call niche-specific. It's a little less suitable maybe for other styles of fishing, so you become a little bit more limited, I think, when you get a niche-specific rod like that.
Right, right. Yeah, and that was the question I had for you was, do you use different rods for different nymphing situations? So if you're not hiking into the backcountry and you're not limited by, weight and so forth, what do you bring along with you?
Well, I think a lot, going back to rod action, too, a lot of times we're seeing, rods that clearly are lighter overall, but they also have that semi-parabolic action where there's a good deal of flex in the tip section, maybe the tip, the one-third or one-half of the rod, but there's a fairly strong spine or backbone to the rod, something that would allow us, to make some of these longer casts that are very underpowered. You need a rod that can still deliver that type of cast. So, again, I look for those features in a rod. Again, knowing that if I'm going to be doing that style of fishing and I choose a very niche-specific rod that, I might not have the right rod in my hands if a blue-wing olive hatch erupts from the surface or something like that. But I think that also goes to line and leader as well. When we get into some very, very specific lines, like some of the new Rio's Euro Nymph line, or Cortland has a new product out too, these are more like running lines. You're not going to really cast those very effectively. So if you're going to try to go from tight line Euro style nymphing to a 50-foot dry fly cast, it isn't going to work.
Right, right, yeah. So you got to be prepared. And also for Dave in Ohio, Dave, I would, if you want to learn more about specifically Euro-style nymphing, I would suggest you go in the archives and look up tactical nymphing Euro-style with Devin Olson that we did a couple months ago. And the last show we did, Nymphing the New Way with Jonathan White out in the UK about French leader. And then the next show we're doing is actually bringing Devin back for Euro-style Part 2 because we had so many questions about it. We've got to bring him back. So we got three shows in the past couple months on Euro-nymphing quite in-depth, and we talked more about rods and stuff in those as well. So good shows to listen to.
Dave mentions also like double taper and weight forward level lines, those types of things as well. And most of the time when we're doing those types of Euro-nymphing that I think he's referencing, you know, we're really not casting much of the line, if any, and we're casting most of the leader. And so the line becomes really less relevant. And I think now Joe Humphreys does use a double tapered line when he does his style of nymph fishing, and he's very successful at it. But most of the newer techniques, you know, the tight line techniques or what we sometimes call contact techniques, the classic Polish or Czech or French or Spanish style, usually we're using pretty much most the leader itself and very little of the line. And that's where you see some of the newer products on the market, which really there's no weight match to them. They're not. You won't find a 4-weight or a 3-weight Euro line because it's all very thin diameter running line. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of one running line. One line fits all, whether you have a 2-weight, a 3-weight, or a 4-weight. It's pretty much the same.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break here, Jason, and when we come back, we'll dive in more and talk about strike indicators and suspension devices. I can't wait to hear this conversation. Anyway, we'll be right back. When you stay at Tarpon Key Lodge in Belize, you are only a step away from fly fishing for tarpon, permit, and bonefish. In fact, you may see a permit tailing right off the deck of your cabana. At Tarpon Key Lodge, you fish the tides, not the clock, and that makes all the difference in the world. You can fish the lagoon for tarpon or the flats for permit and bonefish. It's your choice. Tarpon Key Lodge is located on a private island just 30 minutes from Placentia. You can fish with world-class guides like Charles Leslie Sr., or make it a do-it-yourself trip and take one of the kayaks out and spend the day alone. If you're looking for that grand slam, Tarpon Key Lodge in Belize is the place to go. Book your next adventure now. Visit www.tarponkey.com. That's TARPONCAYE.com. TarponKey.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jason Randall about mastering the nymph. If you'd like to ask Jason the questions, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Jason, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? Well, getting this book published, I know, was a big deal for you. And, you know, I think we've talked about the book a bit more. Do you have a supporting website or anything people can go to or keep track of what you're doing?
Sure. Yeah, so they can go to www.jrflyfishing.com, and it does kind of keep track of things, upcoming articles and, you know, the book and things like that. But it also has a schedule there of fly fishing shows, events, and clubs. And I think I'm just winding up now kind of that part of what we call the show season or the event season. I've got a couple more clubs that I'm looking forward to visiting here in the next few weeks. And then probably by the beginning of May, it's just going to be on the river and fishing and relaxing. Working on a project like this, as you know, there's an awful lot of putting the rod down and picking up the camera or trying different things, and there's a lot of research and a certain amount of work that goes into it. And so I'm really looking forward to just fishing and enjoying that time on the water.
Yeah, you know, in some of these situations, I can imagine with the photography, the illustrations, the writing, you know, to create 2 pages in a book could take days and days worth of effort, you know, to just get that
absolutely
done.
Yeah, I would be interested sometime to see how that does translate, how many hours sitting at the computer versus how many hours on the river. That would be interesting.
Yeah, definitely quite an effort, that's for sure. Well, good. And so you're available for speaking engagements, things like that as well. They can just contact you through the website.
Absolutely. I love to do that.
Okay, great. Well, we had one more question about rods. Camilo Santana in Massachusetts wanted to know what you thought of Tenkara rods for nymphing purposes.
I really like them. We put a section on Tenkara in the book, and I think they're ideally suited for nymph fishing, as they are many other types of fishing, as long as you accept the constraints that are involved, and there are certain pros and cons about anything that we do. And I really enjoyed it. I got a chance in the research part of this book to fish with Yvon Chouinard, who's one of the, you know, real disciple of Tenkara, and we spent a day on the river together, and he's just not only a wonderful angler, very, very adept at using nymphs and wet flies for Tenkara, but just a very interesting man, too, of course, with his company Patagonia. He has a very strong commitment to the outdoors, and we were meeting him for the first time. My family was with us, and we all kind of took bets on what he would be like and what he would drive up in, and we thought, well, you know, we picked everything, every type of vehicle and every type of situation, but the 20-year-old Subaru that he drove up in, and it was just a man of many delights.
Yeah. Wow. Cool. Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like a kind of a Warren Buffett kind of guy.
Yeah, very much so. Very, very normal, and a humble man, and just a passionate angler, too.
Enjoyed
it.
Well, cool. Well, let's talk about strike indicators. You wrote a whole chapter in your book about this, and so I know you've got a lot to say. Are they good, bad, or just plain ugly?
All of the above, right?
All the above. Okay.
Well, I think when we're talking about strike indicators, of course, we're talking about either, you know, what we might call a flotation device or a suspension device. You hear different terms for them, but the classic strike indicator is like a thingamabobber or something akin to that. But you know, and I think these types of strike indicators are one of the best things that ever happened to fly fishing. Because I think they get a lot of people interested in our sport. Maybe it's a family on a vacation out west that hires a guide in a boat, and the guide can, you know, put on a floating strike indicator, and they cast fairly easily at first, just with a water-loaded cast or something like that. And they can get people excited and interested in our sport, to get them engaged in our sport. So it brings a lot of beginners into our sport. But on the other hand, I think these floating indicators are one of the worst things that ever happened in nymph fishing, because they trap us essentially in kindergarten and really do not encourage us to either explore the fullest potential of their use, which we can use them more effectively by changing and addressing some of those points of contact. And they also prevent us from learning alternative techniques and growing as an angler. And too often they become a crutch, and they become our answer for every nymph fishing situation. We're going to nymph fish. Let's just put on a floating indicator. And I think that's not the right way to use them. There's a time and a place to use them and a way to use them. And I don't think we really capitalize on that.
Did you find that there are different devices for different situations? In other words, a thingamabobber versus a yarn, you know, are some good for different situations than others?
I think, some are better than others. Now, Gary Berger, when we fished, one of the times we fished together, shared with me his favorite strike indicator. And he takes just like high-visibility fluorescent egg yarn. He sprays it down with Scotchgard, the waterproofer. Saturates it, lets it dry, and puts a big coil of it in a baggie, and then cuts off whatever appropriate amount he needs and attaches it. And that way he uses an overhand or captured loop, a loop through another loop, to capture that. It doesn't kink up his line the way some of the commercial ones do. That's one of my biggest complaints against them, is they kink up your line, and then when you want to go switch to dry flies, you've got your leader's a kinked up mess. And so also, strike indicators tend to make the problem of drag worse, because they fix a point of your leader, obviously where it attaches to the strike indicator, to the surface, and that surface is moving at the fastest speed for that section of current. So if that's going, you know, 100% speed, then your flies are going 100% speed, and the goal of contact is to slow those flies down to half or maybe one quarter speed so they can drop down into the strike zone and stay there. So when Gary fishes his strike indicator, we know that drag is always worse the faster the water. And so what he does is he overweights his system, either with a heavier anchor fly or with a little split shot, and he slows close down the strike indicator, so the strike indicator is dragging on the surface, going slower than the foam and bubbles that are passing it by on the surface. So he slows it down in slower or medium speed water. But when he gets into really fast water, even then that's not enough. So he tightlines it. He holds it up above the water surface so it doesn't fix that point, and he does a vertical entry presentation like you would see with a Czech-style nymphing. So he adjusts. He's probably one of the best fishermen I've ever seen with strike indicators. He really does know how to get the most out of them. And then another product from Lefty Cray is Lefty Cray's secret little waterproof strike indicator yarn, another type of product like that. You get these products in white, and instead of looking like an orange glowing orb in the water from underneath, if you're filming these strike indicators, these thingamabobbers going overhead, they glow like little neon suns when you look up at them. But these yarn in white colors really look like foam or bubbles on the surface. And that's a great choice. Now, Landon Mayer uses clear or white strike indicators. He likes those airlock ones because they don't kink up the line. And those are much less obtrusive to trout. They don't mind those as much. They do look like a dirty water bubble passing overhead. So I think different situations. I think if I'm midge fishing, I might use two white pinch-on foam indicators because in that situation, those strikes in slower moving or slack water are often very subtle. Strikes in faster moving water are usually very much more obvious because that trout will go into fast current, grab that morsel, and duck right back for cover. So consequently, those strikes are a little more easy to detect. In slower moving water, you need something, a system then, that will detect those really subtle strikes that oftentimes occur in slow moving water when the fish just kind of flares the gills and wafts in the fly. They can eject that fly just as fast if you're not quick. They can cough that fly right back out. So two strike indicators, two of these pinch-on foam indicators in the color of white, about 6 to 9 inches apart or so, will register even the subtlest take, because as they're coming and drifting, I may not be able to see a slight movement if there were just one of them, but the second one there acts as a reference, and if those two move apart very slightly, I set the hook. That's a subtle strike.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I can see how all these different indicators have their uses. What about thingamabobbers? They've been kind of the trend the past several years. Is that what kind of how were they received amongst your experts?
Well, again, I think there's certainly a place in the market for them. I think they've improved on their own original design with some of the new modifications they have now that tend not to kink up the line. If you're going to use a flotation device, you really need to change the location or in your leader to allow for different depths as you move from one water type to another. And so I think with those frequent adjustments needed, some of the newer improvements in the thingamabobber have helped reduce line kink and some of those other things that were there 10 or 15 years ago. So I think they're still in common use. I think there's other alternatives as well. You know, I don't want to disparage any particular brand.
Yeah, yeah. Was there one type of device that was used more often with the experts than others?
Yeah, I think you're seeing when we are using floating indicators, I think the yarn is a pretty common one. Thingamabobbers are still relatively common, too. I think, in my opinion, the airlock system is a little bit of an improvement over that because the airlock one actually has two rubber bushings that a screw, you have a screwed lockdown device, and it traps that between two rubber bushings. So it makes the system very, very versatile, and you can move it up and down. It doesn't kink the line. Now, Tom Baltz, also one of the nymph masters, loves the New Zealand strike indicator system, which is that tiny tuft of yarn or lamb's wool that's pulled through a piece of a very small segment of like quarter-inch diameter clear surgical tubing, and it moves up and down the line fairly easily. It doesn't really kink it. It is really, really nice for finesse situations like midge fishing, but it really won't, as a suspension device, it really won't hang or suspend heavier flies because it doesn't have that much buoyancy. But he fishes that system extremely well, and it is a very, very good and versatile system, especially maybe to in a more finesse type of situation.
Okay. Don in Belgrade, Montana, wrote in and said, asked about if any particular strike indicator had, you know, less impact on casting, and was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Oh, that's a good question. It is. They really do. You know, you especially if you have a device that puts a right 90-degree elbow turn in your leader, like a thingamabobber can, something that passes over and loops, it interrupts the linear aspect of the leader and puts a bend in it. So that really can complicate anyone that's casting tight loops, or if you have a tailing loop, it's going to be a disaster of tangles. And so I think you end up casting a much more open loop with those because they tend to snag on you because of that bend in the leader. And I do like the AeroLock system. It does not put that 90-degree angle bend in it. It maintains the linear connection. Strike Foundry also has a good system that I got a chance to use during the work on this book as well. It has it's a buoyant device that has a fluorescent upper and a kind of a neutral lower, so it doesn't have that much, it doesn't flare fish as easily as some of the other devices, but you can also tie it in line. It has an eye at the top and an eye at the bottom so that you can literally tie it in line so that it doesn't put an elbow turn or bend in your leader. As well. Also, I think casting in the wind when you put something up there that has a little larger surface area can make a difference. I always kind of try to follow the rule of thumb that I use the smallest indicator flotation device that I can to suspend the flies that I'm fishing.
And given the water condition.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you have heavy riffles or something, you need something larger, and if it's totally flat or spring creek, then you've got a different situation like you were talking about before. Yeah. A couple questions came in on the Internet, Jason. Treg in Moscow, Idaho, wants to know if you use the strike indicator with a screw top.
That's the AeroLock one.
That's the AeroLock one, okay.
Yeah, and that's good. I think it's relatively new on the market, and I do like it for those reasons. It's a very good fastening device. It doesn't slip. But I can move it very easily up and down the leader. It doesn't kink my line. And it is easier for me to cast than some of the other devices that will bend, put a bend in a right angle turn in your leader. So I like them. I do. AeroLock is it's a very, very good product.
Another one, Dave in Minneapolis wants to know about BioStrike.
Yeah, BioStrike is the one I just mentioned.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh no. You know what? I mentioned Strike Foundry. BioStrike is the putty that's a Loon product, I believe, and it's a very, very good product as a visual strike indicator. It's also, I think, a great application in some of the really light flies like midge fishing, but it's not much of a suspension device. BioStrike is a putty that is usually a high visible putty, and you attach it to your leader. If I'm using BioStrike, and again, Tom Balch uses a lot of BioStrike too, use a couple different dollops of the BioStrike, maybe 6 or 9 inches apart, because I think it also, as the same way that we're using those white pinch-on foam indicators, sometimes it helps with those subtle strikes. I use it over spooky fish with very, very light flies. It doesn't suspend flies very well. You're not going to be able to use heavy flies with it. But just
more like a cider then.
Kind of it is
between a cider and an indicator, huh?
That's right, and that's how Tom fishes it as well. More often than not, he puts those three dollops on and will cast lighter flies upstream, but if he wants to switch up, he maybe put a heavier fly on, he'll tight line it with a vertical entry using it literally as a sider. So it is a pretty versatile product, and I have used it, there are certain aspects of it that I do like.
Yeah, okay, good. We're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back, talk more about leaders and tippet and weight and all kinds of things, so stick with us, folks. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everybody taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado, located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com, or call 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Jason Randall about Mastering the Nymph. If you'd like to ask Jason questions, go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately and try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. I've got another question here on the Internet from Treg. I'm not familiar with this term, but he's talking about, wants to know about short leashing. Does that have to do with indicators, or is that a term you're familiar with?
No, I'm not familiar with that term either.
Okay. Treg, you'll have to explain better. Neither of us know what you're talking about, so which that doesn't mean anything because there's so much in this world to learn about.
It means nothing, no, because there's so many new variations and techniques and stuff like that it's really hard to stay abreast with it, and Treg may be onto something.
Treg probably made it up himself. It's probably his own system. He's just
he'll have a book out there. I'll be calling in to ask him questions.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about leaders in tippet. Eric Halloran in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, wants to know if you could tell us about your end tackle configurations for droppers.
Well, it would probably vary depending on the system I was using somewhat. And there's probably more variation in leaders and tippet and terminal arrangement than any other area. I mean, the French-style leaders, the strike indicator leaders, the Czech-style leaders, they're all quite different. And I think mostly what he's addressing is just mostly the arrangement of the flies, perhaps, and maybe the weight distribution.
How you tie them on properly,
I'll assume that, and I think there are several different ways of connecting the flies. You can connect flies from eye to eye to eye all the way down, where the first fly, connects from the tippet to the eye of the fly, and then the second length of tippet comes from the eye of that same fly and goes to the eye of the second fly, and then you trail another fly from the eye of the second fly to the third fly. So those flies essentially then only have connections, even though there's two connections on the upper two flies, they only have connections to the hook eye. This allows a lot of freedom of movement and liberty for the fly, and I love that if I'm going to be like San Juan worms, where I really want that to move in the water and to freely interact with the current. When we tie in series or from the hook shank of the preceding fly, there's some restriction on that movement. And in some cases, I don't think it's a negative. Something a scud that more swims in a straight fashion. They're not strong swimmers, but they swim. I don't think it affects them as much. But something like that San Juan worm, I want to have maximum freedom and liberty of that fly, so I'll hook them up differently than I might a scud or a crest bug. Fishing with Joe Humphreys, he has usually a two-fly rig. He uses a blood knot with a tag end for a very light, unweighted fly as his dropper, and then the trailing fly is a little heavier weighted, something like a scud or a crest bug. But then he puts his weight not in front of the blood knot, right behind the blood knot. And then he puts a little overhand knot behind it to keep it from sliding down towards the trailing fly. It's a very different way of hooking up the flies. Mm-hmm. But the reason he does that, again, he's solving those problems of contact. He has his sinkers make the contact, and then the trailing fly stays in the lowest layer of the strike zone, but it allows that dropper, which might be a size 16 or 18 unweighted pheasant tail nymph or something like that, it allows that to kind of drift a little higher in the strike zone, maybe 4 inches or 5 inches off of the bottom. And it really kind of covers two layers of that strike zone, which is a very interesting theory. And there's other methods that are trying to achieve that same result. And he's gotten so adept at that that he could, even when we were fishing, one of the first time that I think I fished with him, we used this technique, and he could tell the difference between a take on the upper fly, that small unweighted pheasant tail. He could tell the difference between a take on that fly and the trailing fly. And the reason is that they took the trailing fly that was close to the bottom, that fish just opened his mouth and grabbed it, and the drift would stop. Okay, but if he took the fly that was a little higher, it would actually cause his rod tip to dip a little bit. He could feel it because the fish would grab the fly and go to the bottom with it and pull it down. It's pretty cool. It works.
Yeah.
Another little bit of wisdom he shared with me on one of our river trips together was the difference between a good nymph angler and a great nymph angler. It's two split shot. Isn't
that
great? Getting your
a little bit deeper.
Getting the flies to the bottom.
Yeah, yeah.
Keeping them in the strike zone.
Yeah, interesting. We had a follow-up question from Craig about the bio strike. He wants to know if you need to put a knot in there to keep it in one spot?
Yeah, I think it works better, and that's really a good point. But a lot of times I'll put it over a blood knot or a surgeon's knot or something like that, because I think it helps it stick there. And the biggest problem I have is that, in cold weather it won't stick real well. It kind of crumbles on you. And, sometimes I keep it in my inner pocket on my inside my waders to keep it a little warmer. And sometimes it pops off. It's supposed to be, biodegradable, but I always worry about leaving anything in the river, so I'm a little conscious of that. But I think Trike's point is a good one. Putting it over a knot and really rolling it on a knot does help keep it in place and keep it attached to the line better.
Mm-hmm.
Good
okay.
advice.
Yeah. I wanted you to kind of, I'm looking at some of the diagrams in the book. We're talking about getting that fly to the bottom. And we're talking about weight. We've got a couple questions on weight as well. But I want to kind of keep connected with those indicators we were talking about, too. So, you can have some examples of, like trying to get that fly down on the back side of the rock or the front side of a rock or, over a drop-off, those kind
mm-hmm.
of things. And you're using kind of a certain kind of men to do that. Can you kind of explain how you're getting, why it's not getting there in the first place and how you're getting it down into where those fish are at in that slow current?
You bet. I think, one of the real negatives of nymph fishing, especially when you have a flotation device that's causing with its large surface areas, is really dragging your flies. It actually drags those flies like a reluctant puppy learning how to walk on a leash. It's just dragging them along at the fastest speed. So those flies tend to rise up in the water column, and they don't drop in behind rocks and pockets and drop-offs and things like that. Where the fish are holding, they're shooting over their heads. It turns our flies, instead of a dead drifting fly that looks like a natural insect, it turns it into a little subsurface torpedo that's shooting through the water much, much faster than it should, because, again, if that strike indicator is going at full speed, so are the flies. And we want those flies to be going at quarter to half speed, tumbling along the bottom. So we've got to find a way then to correct that. And just like dry fly fishing, we can mend it. We mend to correct for drag in dry fly fishing. You're going to hear more and more about mending your strike indicator to allow and correct for drag as well, vertical drag. So you could do it. Sometimes you'll hear it referred to as checking your indicator, but what it is really either stopping the indicator dead in the water or lifting the indicator up off of the water surface and repositioning it upstream, pulling it upstream a little bit. What that does is it allows, it reduces the drag off the flies, allows them to sink, which they normally would sink. Things do sink in rivers. I've dropped my car keys in enough rivers to know. if there's no drag, they'll sink. And they'll get behind those ledges, and they'll get behind those rocks, and they'll target those fish. So you can really mend your flies and feed those flies right into those fish-holding lines. So mending or checking your indicator is a pretty new, in the last 5 years or so, more and more people are using this as a way of getting the most out of those floating indicators.
Yeah, it makes total sense for me, and it's something I'm going to try next week for sure when I'm out, because it's always a challenge. You know, the fish are down there, you know, and...
Oh, yeah.
And more times than not, you're getting up, getting to them. And I think that's a great tip. That's worth the whole show right there for people to learn how to do that. That's great. A couple other questions about leaders and stuff. Ted in Alamo, California, mono versus fluorocarbon, knotted versus smooth taper, tapered versus level. What are the best practices for nymphing leaders and tippets?
Great. It's a great topic and a very controversial and hot topic in nymph fishing. And, you know, I think there are some generalities that apply, and then I think there's a lot of individual preferences. For me, from my standpoint, I want everything that's going to be beneath the surface of the water to be as thin as possible so that it can cut through the current, because I want to be able to cut through the current to keep my flies moving slower than the general current. So that means in the mid part of the layers, I have to cut through those in order to keep them at the bottom. So I want something thin. I'm going to use fluorocarbon. It tends to be thinner pound for pound than mono. It also has a little bit better light properties, so it tends to disappear in water just a little bit better than mono, a little less visible. But it's also pretty tough, scratch and abrasion resistant. So most of what I'm going to be doing is using, fluorocarbon beneath it, and I'd like to keep it as thin and level as I can. Most of that below that I would not want to have tapered, any type of a taper down there. Above the water, I think it's a little less of a factor. For me, I'll use more likely use monofilament up there. And then the upper part of that leader would be very different depending on the different styles of fishing I might do. A French leader nowadays is not uncommon to see one that's 35 feet. A Czech-style nymph leader might be 12 to 14 or 15 or so. So it really depends at that point on what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The Ed Constantini asked, what type of nymphing leader do you prefer for small stream fishing? Length and tighter and formula is what he's asking about.
Oh, I think Ed must fish the same rivers I do, because I'm a Midwestern native too, and I think we're in love with the same streams. You know, the streams in Wisconsin and the Driftless area. A lot of them in the northern part of the state that are just absolute delights. And so on those streams, I mean, it's typically classic skinny water, a lot of spring-fed stuff. So I think I'm typically gearing myself more towards a lighter equipment. I might use my 8-foot three-weight BVK because, again, I will only use the amount of rod length or the amount of leader length that I can control under the circumstance. In a small stream, you know, I may not be able to to use a really, really long rod if it's tightly guarded, closely guarded by vegetation and overhanging branches. But again, you know, there's some areas in those streams that are wide open and really well suited for those longer rods. And a lot of times on those spring creeks and spring creeks everywhere, those trout can be pretty spooky. And so in that situation, I might find myself using a longer rod and maybe a French-style leader that's 30, 35 feet and a very light presentation, light tippet, light flies, because I don't want to spook those trout.
Yeah. More Don in Kentucky asked, color as it relates to indicators in line, do you see a reason to avoid these bright indicators in line front ends?
I haven't, no, and I know Rio has come out with that Euro nymphing line that they have that has about a foot of a real bright color at the tip of the fly line where it would attach to the leader. And because that really isn't that visible to the trout, because it's usually within my guides of my rod, it's usually not out of the rod tip. I really don't think it, for me, it's a big problem. I think the cider, the high visibility ciders, possibly would have more, you know, more impact on the trout, because those are right at the water surface or in the water. I haven't noticed anything myself, but it's a, you know, it's an interesting observation.
Yeah.
I haven't really seen anything on for me anyway.
Yeah, and Dick in Illinois is asking about the formula for French-style nymphing leader. I would refer you, Dick, to the last show we did. Talked a lot about that. So go listen to our last show, and you'll get a lot of information.
Yeah, I know Dick. Dick's a good guy. He's a great angler, and I give him a shout-out here. Yeah, a good guy and a good angler. But I do think those French-style leaders are some of the more sophisticated leaders in nymph fishing, because if you think about it, you have, you say you do have a 35-foot leader, and you're casting a size 16 bead head as the heaviest fly. That's not a lot of mass, and there's no fly line to cast. So those leaders have to be super efficient in the transmission of energy down the length to get those flies to turn over. And so I think you'll see a lot of those leaders that are much more sophisticated, I think, as a result of that. And there's so many different ones that are published, you know, for different situations. Boisson's short-range French leader is probably one of the more common ones. It has a cider in it, and it is pretty well on the internet, so I think it's fairly easy to find. There's also a few other ones as well that are fairly common. Philippe Boisson is probably one of the ones you see referenced the most, but usually they have a lot of hand-tied incremental segments that incrementally decrease in diameter. Each one is about 30 to 36 inches, and they go down a couple thousandths of an inch to something like 5 or 6x, sometimes even 7x tippet at the end. So they are more sophisticated. Now, a check leader is a lot coarser. You just aren't doing that finesse. I mean, you're fishing heavier flies, faster water, and so I think those tend to be simpler leader formulas.
Yeah, Chuck in Santa Rosa, California, want to know if you recommend the drop-shotting technique that Kelly Gallup mentions.
You know, that's a fairly new variant of an older technique, you know. And again, I think Kelly's he's done a very good job of describing and advocating this technique, and it's very successful. It achieves those points of contact that we're really looking for in nymph fishing. I think his technique, because it's rigged a little bit differently, in a way similar to Joe's, it allows flies to present at different layers of the strike zone, maybe at the very bottom, and then maybe just a little bit higher in the strike zone. So there's some advantages I think I see to it, but the biggest advantage it offers is contact. You're in contact with the bottom, and you're in contact with your flies, and so I think it does the job. It's very similar to some of the older Chuck and Duck's steelhead techniques that we did, where we had sliding sinkers, you know, similar to, I think, a lot of these things we borrowed from the bass fishing world or the walleye fishing world, where we had minnow harnesses and worm harnesses and sliding sinkers and slinkies and all kinds of different weighted devices. But I think it gets the job done. I think it's another technique. We used to call it chuck and duck for obvious reasons, because if you chuck, you'd better duck. Otherwise, it would hit you in the back of the head. But it does meet the goals of contact for sure, and it's a good technique.
What weighting methods did you see that worked best out of the different ones the experts you fished with used?
Well, you do have to achieve an anchor point of some sort. You've got to get those flies to the bottom, and again, Gary Borger overbalances his rig a little bit to make sure, again, he emphasizes not only does he want his flies to get to the bottom, but he wants them to stay there once vertical drag sets in. And so an anchor point is essential, whether you use a split shot or some other type of a weighted device, or whether you use an anchor fly. An anchor fly is more common in those Euro-nymphing styles of fishing, where you're using a heavy weighted fly to achieve your anchor point. The advantage of that is you do catch flies or fish on your anchor flies. Anchor flies have been probably a very, very interesting and hot topic in our sport as well, and I've got a great source of anchor flies is tied by Tom Starmack at zoeticflies.com. They're kind of hard to find, and there's a lot of science that goes into it, and some are better than others.
You went by pretty quick, Tom.
Yeah, his website, again, it's a commercial fly tire that sells these in the States, is zoeticflies.com.
Can you spell that, Zio?
Yeah, Zoetic flies, FLIES.com. And they're well constructed. They're affordable. Sometimes you can pay way too much for them. These flies are really a great source to get started, or even for people who are well experienced in this. It's really, really good flies at good prices.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Let's talk about, you spent quite a bit of time in your book talking about food distribution in rivers and streams and feeding lanes. And can you describe maybe some of the more common feeding lanes, and then maybe talk about what a lot of us fly fishers might miss, on a river?
Yeah, for sure. I think we can learn a lot by reading the water. And not only does reading the water tell us about feeding lanes and food distribution and then trout lies, but it also tells us how to fish, too. Strike indicators, floating strike indicators. I try to avoid them in fast water situations. I also try to avoid them in pocket water, because the current in pocket water is chaos. There's current moving in every different direction. The surface current might be moving in one direction, and 2 or 3 inches later it's going in an opposite direction. So floating strike indicators, I'll never use them in pocket water. There's a lot of food that builds up in pocket water because the current is a lot like wind. The leaves in your yard accumulate behind the bushes and behind the snow fence and behind the trees. And so you have to look for those areas when you're reading the water and studying the current. So the first thing that I do when I look at a stretch of water is I look for food distribution. I look for the primary feeding lane. Sometimes you can't find one. It's not easy to find, especially in riffles. You might see multiple secondary feeding lanes, and where those might converge might be a great place to fish. But the feeding lanes are always the first place to start, because that's where the food is. The food is that's like the conveyor belt for food in the river. Once I identify the feeding lanes, then I'll look for individual trout lies alongside those feeding lanes, and that's usually is going to get you on to fish. Also, like transition areas in rivers, areas where maybe a fast water section like a riffle tails out into a deeper pool or a flat. I look for areas where there's a change in current speed and depth, because a lot of times the food that's picked up by the current and carried in the current will float and be carried through the current or through the riffles or the rapids or the run, and then it will start to settle out once that water slows in those transition areas, and then the trout are just lined up there feeding on that food as it drops out of the current. It's always a great place to fish.
Okay. Question off the internet here. I don't know who didn't leave a name here, but it says, please describe how you fish a team of three very light flies on a long leader, specifically dealing with even a little wind.
There's someone who's done it. Yeah, that could be hard. You know, that's one thing they don't tell you about is on those real windy days and you're trying to hold off a lot of that leader and line off the water from a long distance with light flies that don't anchor well, it can be really, really tough. Sometimes in that situation, you're forced to go to an alternative technique simply because it's not that you can't do it. It's just, in some cases, it can't be done.
Right.
I remember I was fishing with Ed Engel, and one of the times we were fishing actually up in the Driftless area of Wisconsin together and doing some of the work for this book. And I love to do that long-range, tight-line French-style nymphing. And he was under a different section and catching fish, and I wasn't. You know, so I couldn't control the drift, and I ended up having to switch to a different technique as well. So sometimes a heavier fly helps because that's more resistance to the pull and more resistance to the wind. So sometimes putting a heavier fly on would help with the wind. Sometimes when the wind is that bad, you're going to have to either shorten your range and do it from a shorter distance or put a heavier fly on, or it just can't be done.
Another internet comment question. Bill Kaiser asks, when you present a fly at one quarter, one half speed, it seems to be unnatural presentation, right?
It is relative to the surface current that you see. But again, remember that the current that the trout sees is one quarter, one half speed. And so that's why the trout are on the bottom, because they don't want to fight the full effect of the current. But that current also, if you look at it vertically, forms a gradient. Okay, so you've got the fastest water in the middle, and it drops off dramatically because of friction closer to the bottom. And that's like a snowplow, and it just pushes the food to the bottom. And so that's the current speed that the flies, the natural bugs are drifting. They're drifting at a much slower speed than the mid-current or the faster stretch, faster part of the water that we might notice from the surface. So slowing down the flies is an essential part of nymph fishing, getting them to that speed relative to the strike zone. The slower speed at the bottom is in fact a natural presentation speed, even though it seems maybe that it isn't.
We have a question from John in Guilford. I don't know what state. He says, for identifying a strike, do you recommend relying on seeing a flash of belly where you're expecting him to be? I know a lot of people look for the mouth, white of the mouth as well.
Yeah, the blink or the flash. I'm an optimist. If I see a flash of a fish, I set the hook. They say hook sets are free. You know, if I think that flash or that blink or that juke of the trout's position, he moved suddenly like he intercepted a fly or a piece of food, I'm going to set the hook, because sometimes you just can't tell. And even the most sensitive strike indicator systems are not 100%. They improve the odds a lot. But if I have a visual reference of a strike, I'm going to assume it's on my flies.
Hey, Barry in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. When I high stick nymphs, I am having a hard time feeling the nymph ticking the bottom. I was recently fishing in clear conditions with a brightly colored, cough gag, mop fly. And see,
hey, we all use them. and squirmy worms, too.
Could see the fly bouncing on the bottom, but I couldn't feel it. Do you have any tips on to improve sensing the location of the fly as it moves through a pool? Trying to keep my rod in position, as discussed in GD's dynamic nymphing.
Yeah, that would be George Daniels.
And yeah, George Daniels.
George Daniels is a contributor to this book as well, and he talks about the 20% rule. He likes to feel bottom on 20% of his drifts, and if he's not, then he's got to change something. You know, maybe it is adding a very dramatic tuck cast to drill his flies to the bottom and let them, get to the bottom before the drift begins. Or maybe it's adding a little bit of weight. But sometimes I think with the lighter flies, you can't always feel bottom. I mean, it isn't that dramatic as it is with a heavier check nymph. And so that's a good point that Barry addresses. But one of the other cues that you can use is the speed of your drift. And so if the speed of your drift is correct, if your speed is moving slower than the speed that you see in the general current from above, if your leader is cutting through the current, then I think you're probably in the strike zone or close to it anyway. There's a kind of a new philosophy of that as well, that I've talked to some people that really don't want to feel bottom, but they just want to be close to the bottom, and they use the speed of the drift as an indication. If their drift is moving at 1/4 to 1/2 speed, they figure that their flies are in the strike zone.
Yeah, okay. Dave Betcher in North Fork, California says, I fly fish, and I can't wait to hear the answer on this because I'm very interested myself. I fly fish on the west slopes of the Central Sierra. The streams, creeks are mostly plunge pools, approximately 85 to 90% of the fishable stream. The pools can be 5 to 20 feet in diameter. What's the best nymphing technique to use in these types of plunge pools?
You know, I think, again, the first thing that we want to do in reading the water is deciding the best way to fish it, and I think that's what his question really is looking at. And what I do is I divide that stretch of water into high or low confidence lies. High confidence lies means that trout are happy to be there, they feel safe, they feel protected, they feel secure, and you can get close enough to them to check nymph. High confidence lies would be fast moving water where the surface of the water is broken or white with maybe white water with air bubbles, or maybe it's opaque water or deeper water, or there's overhanging trees. Something is giving them the security to feed with high confidence. A low confidence lie, by contrast, is unapproachable fish, spooky fish, nervous fish, and those might be gin clear water, shallow water, flat water with bare movement, those types of things. That's a low confidence lie. You can't get very close to those fish without spooking it, and you'd better use a longer range technique, more like a French leader style. If you've got a high confidence lie, you can crowd those fish. You can get a little closer to them to use a short range technique like a Czech nymph or Polish nymph style. So again, I look at high confidence lies and low confidence lies. A high confidence lie is like laying in the hotel room in your pajamas, eating delivery pizza, watching ESPN. You're safe, you're happy, you're comfortable. That's a high confidence lie. A low confidence lie for me living near Chicago would be like eating at a sidewalk cafe on the south side of Chicago. I might eat, but I'd be nervous. I'd be worried about drive-by shooting.
Okay. Yeah, right.
That's the difference. And so on low confidence lies, back up. Use a finesse technique. Use a longer range technique, whether it's dry flies or nymph fishing. And so to me, his description of these plunge pools, that's clear water and kind of skinny water, that type of thing, I think that's a low confidence lie. And I think that really tells me how to fish. So anytime that I look at a stretch of water, I'm going to look, is this a high confidence area? Can I get close to these trout without spooking them? Or is it a low confidence area? That always tells me how to fish.
And then how would you fish it?
I would fish it as a low confidence lie. This is a situation where I would get as far away from it as I could, because if I spook fish in that kind of skinny water, the whole pool will blow up. So if I spook one fish out of that pool, it's probably going to blow up the whole pool.
But would you fish it with an indicator? Would you fish check style?
No. If it depends on how far I could get away from it. If I could get away from it and still use a tight line technique, I probably would do that, with a long, maybe 25 feet distance, maybe somewhere approaching a French type of presentation. If I couldn't get that close to it, if I had to be back further away from it, I might use something, either grease the leader or use a curlicue leader or something like that, so that it still remains a very, very finesseful technique, but it's something I would do from further distance away. So, I made this mistake myself. I might blow up the first pool to see how close I could get to the fish so that I could be better prepared to fish the next pool.
Okay, good. Gene in Spring Grove, Pennsylvania wants to know how long you fish before changing flies. What is the trigger?
I think my opinion is that you'll catch more fish on a maybe not the correct fly, but one that's properly presented, than you will on the very best chosen fly that's poorly presented. So I think presentation always trumps fly choice, because I think a lot of times trout are feeding more or less opportunistic. They'll take a multitude of different food sources. When fish are really, really selective, meaning that they're keyed in on one particular food source, I think the fly choice becomes a bigger determinant. And so, again, I might, if I have cast, maybe a pre-sighted fish multiple times, and I know that my fly is in the drift zone and the strike zone, and it's in the lane of that trout, and he's not looked at it, but I've had a good presentation out of him, I've cast multiple times to him, I would say I'm going to change flies because something's not right.
Yeah. We had a follow-up question from Treg, and he was asking about, if you're fishing from a boat drifting using an indicator, how often do you check the indicator to slow the flies down in those kind of situations?
That's a really insightful question. And that's one of the times I will use a floating indicator from a drift boat, because if you don't use a floating indicator, all your drifts end up being right next to the boat, because they eventually come under the rod tip. So in a floating strike indicator is a fixed point where it kind of sets your drift a certain distance away from the boat. So I do use floating indicators in drift boats and in those situations as my preferred method of choice. But what I do is I'm a lot more interactive now with my drifts than I used to be. I used to put them out there and let them go for 300 yards and wonder why I didn't catch any fish. And that's because I was letting the river drift my flies. Now I'm taking control of my drift. I'm fishing the flies. I'm controlling the drift now. And so I might switch sides a lot more. If I see a good-looking structure coming up on the left, I might cast over there. And then if it's a drop-off, or a boulder or something like that, and I've got, say, 6 feet beneath my indicator to my flies, I will mend or check the indicator 6 feet before my presentation gets to that structure, 6 feet in front of that ledge, 6 feet in front of that drop off. If I have 8 feet beneath the strike indicator, then I'll mend 8 feet in front of that so that I allow those flies to drop in on those fish right at the time that they need to. And then if something looks a little better on the other side of the boat, I'll water load the cast and put it on the other side, and I'll mend right before I get to those likely looking spots, a distance in front of those spots equal to whatever distance I have below the indicator.
Okay. And one comment, too, about what you were talking about, presentation versus match the hatch kind of thing. And I remember I did and people can look this up in our archive, a show called Fish Food with Ralph Cutter, and he did a lot of diving. And,
he's a very, very good, well-researched writer.
Yeah, and he did a lot of diving and watching the fish. And, after doing that, he says, we miss so many opportunities to hook up because these fish are, if the food is in the zone, they're taking it in and spitting it out so often, and we don't even know it's happening.
I completely agree. I think we obsess a lot more too much, maybe more on having the absolutely perfect fly to whatever match, whatever food source, and we don't pay enough attention to the presentation.
I think that's a good note to end the night on. So stick with us here, folks. We are out of time, but we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And we'll also be giving away a copy of Jason's book, Nymphmasters, courtesy of Stackpole Books, stackpolebooks.com. So, Jason, stick with me, too. I'm going to have you help me with make sure I get the right answers. And so just give us a few more minutes. We'll get through and give away some prizes. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org to learn more and to get involved. Again, it's SaveBristolBay.org. And just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us some feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away a few prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. And so if you didn't sign up for that earlier, it's too late now. But please do so for the next show so that you can have a chance on winning one of these great prizes. So the first thing we're giving away is 1 year membership to the International Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the International Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org. fedflyfishers.org. So our winner for that is Jim Lamb in California. So congratulations, Jim, on that membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And next up is going to be a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at amatobooks.com. Again, a great publisher of fly fishing books and periodicals. So check them out at mottobooks.com. And our winner for that is, come on, database, get going here. Fred Iratty, I'm not sure which it is. In New Jersey. So, Fred, congratulations on that one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And I know you'll enjoy that. Fred's out in New Jersey. Okay, got that noted. And now, giveaway Jason's book. And if you don't win this tonight, folks, go out and get it, Nymphmasters. You won't be disappointed. And it's going to improve your fishing, I guarantee it. So check it out. Let's see here. I got to clear my queue here, make sure everything's out of here. And to win Jason's book, you have to answer this question. There's three parts to the answer of this question. I want you to name, first and last name, three of the people that Jason fished with that he mentioned tonight that contributed to this book. Three of those fly fishers that contributed to the book. First and last names. So, do that, you're going to win Jason's book. So this might be kind of tough on him, Jason, but I want to make this worth it.
Right.
And all the people you mentioned are incredible fly fishers. A lot of them we've had on the show here. I remember talking with Joe Humphreys about I can just picture where you guys were fishing because he talked about it. I mean, there must be bushes and trees all over the place. You know?
Oh, it was great. You know, we had such a good time together, and he's such a colorful person.
Yeah, yeah. And we have, I think we've got a winner here, but I want to check. The answer he put in is Joe Humphreys, Gary Borger, and George Daniels.
There you go.
And that is David Willem in Minneapolis. So congratulations, David. Good job, first one in, and absolutely correct answer. There were others that you could have put in there, but those are they're just fine and all great fly fishers, so congratulations. And, David, if you'll, in that same text box, send us your address, your shipping address, so we can get Stackpole to send a book over to you. I'd appreciate it. Or you can send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. So congratulations, David, and thanks for paying attention and listening in with us tonight. Jason, I really want to thank you for being with us again. Always a pleasure to talk with you and suck your mind of knowledge. As you suck
Roger.
Those experts' minds of knowledge. And
it was enjoyable.
We all help each other. Huh?
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's lots of fun, and I always enjoy talking with you. So have a great summer fishing.
Thanks. And you too. I hope to see you on the river.
Yeah. Our next broadcast will be May 3rd, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And in that show, we're going to interview Devin Olson. And our topic for the show will be tactical nymphing, Eurostyle, Part 2. So Devin Olson, the medal-winning member of the Fly Fishing Team USA, shares the modern-day nymphing techniques he and Lance Egan use to catch fish in the European style. When competing on an international basis, you have to be good and have to know how to adapt. And on this show, we had so many questions on Devin's first show that this is part two. We're going at it again. We're going to continue. So send in more questions. We'll continue the questions we didn't get to last time. It's going to be another great show. So join us then. We'd like to thank the International Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Tarpon Key Lodge, Watermaster, and Royal Gorge Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com. Make sure you signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. And be sure to check out the archive. Hopefully you've all found that. It's at the bottom of the page of every page. You can go in there and look up past shows. We've got like 250 shows in there. Just use the keyword like trout, tarpon, Madison River, whatever, and you will find incredible library of information. That's it for tonight. Good night, everyone, and good fishing. Welcome.